Hi there, dear people. Welcome to this newest episode of For Real. I'm your host, Kim Stewart, and I'm just going to take a big, deep breath about getting to talk with my guest for today. Amanda Held Opelt joins me on the podcast today, and I counted it such a privilege to talk with her about her new and debut book, A Hole in the World. Amanda's book is part memoir, part history of bereavement ritual, and altogether one of the most stunning books I've ever read, particularly on the subjects of grief and community and faith. Amanda joined me from her home in Appalachia, and I'm just so grateful for her generosity of time and spirit. So pull up a chair and a generous cup of coffee. This is my conversation with author, speaker, and songwriter, Amanda Held Opelt. Amanda Held Opelt, thank you for joining me on For Real. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Kim, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to chat with you.
Well, you just told me that you like Iowans. And so now you are in the will for me because it just doesn't happen. I just spent a weekend with folks who kept saying, Iowa, Iowa. So where is that again? And I've never been there. So this is such a balm to my heart that you know where it is.
I love Iowans. My best friend is from Iowa. My husband's from Wisconsin. I don't know. Like when you grow up in the South, you kind of think that like Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, like they're all kind of the same. So I recognize that they are different, but my aunt and uncle are in Iowa. And I've been there lots of times and I just love my upper Midwesterners. Like you are good people. And so it's just, you put me at ease. I feel at ease as we go into this conversation.
I love that. I want to assure you, we also have a lot of crazy people. So
I don't need to know that. I don't need to know that.
Okay, we'll just keep that up. Well, thank you for thinking the best of us. I have, I'm very nervous about talking to you. And here's why.
Okay.
I'm not typically a nervous person.
Okay.
Your book is a gobsmacker. I am at a loss. So before we do one darn thing, okay, I just want to tell you, Amanda, that I will not do justice to the book that you wrote. I don't know that I frequently say that, but that is the truth, Ruth. I'm nervous that what I will say does not hold the weight of what you have said. So that's the kind of book we're talking about here today, people. So
that is so kind and so encouraging. It's, you know, what every writer wants to hear is that their words reached people in a place that mattered, you know? So thank you.
Oh man, did they. And we are going to talk about that. Before we go one more step, I'd love for those who are just meeting you, tell us who you are, tell us how you spend your days and with whom you spend your days.
You know, I live in a small town in southern Appalachia. I've always lived in the greater Appalachian region and love this place, call it home. Spent a little bit of time abroad, spent a little bit of time in Nashville, but this is home. And I live with my husband, who I've been married to 13 years as of last week, and we've got two little girls. I spent the last 15 or 16 years of my life working in social services, in lower income neighborhoods. And then primarily most of my career has been in the aid industry. I always clarify, I wasn't a proper aid worker. I was not the person going to the disaster zone to hand out the food or write up the proposals, but I worked in kind of staff care and resilience training for aid workers. And so just holding the pain that they held as a result of seeing the things that they saw and kind of allowed me the opportunity to see the world and some of the hard places in the world. And so I've shifted in the last year and a half to focus on writing, and that gives me a little bit of flexibility to chase my toddlers around. And that's who I am. And that's what I do.
Yes. And so talk to me then, to just set up some scaffolding, share with me how you came to write a memoir about the rituals of grief and healing. And I didn't say the name of the book. I'll say it in the intro, but I'm going to say it again.
It's fine.
A Hole in the World. The subtitle is Finding Hope in Rituals of Grief and Healing. So how did you go from helping folks on the front lines of humanitarian aid to writing this book?
Well, I mean, if you had told me 4 years ago that I'd be writing a book about historic bereavement rituals, you could have knocked me over with a feather. Like I had never believed you, because I had led this just, I mean, now I see it as privilege. I had led this just very peace-filled, everything according to plan life, you know, and, you know, I had a very stable, trauma-free childhood, awesome parents, well-adjusted Christian household, not heavy-handed with faith, but a welcoming faith that has sustained me all these years. Wonderful older sister, sweet husband. I mean, things just kind of went well for me. And I don't know why I thought I was entitled to that kind of ease for the rest of my life. But in my mind, like, tragedies were things that happened to other people. And even being an aid worker reinforced this. Tragedy is something that happens out there. I fly there and have a wild couple of weeks, and then I fly home out of it. You know, I get to leave the heartache. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I started having kind of a series of just very difficult experiences. I had a grandmother I was really close to who died really suddenly while I was kind of stuck in East Africa on a work trip and couldn't get out to go to her funeral. I walked through a season of infertility, and after years of that, finally became pregnant and then lost that pregnancy. And that became the first of three pregnancies that I would lose. And then probably the atom bomb that went off in my life, you know, that, you know, a lot of people have a before and after event, right? It's like the thing that happened where they remember their life before that thing, and then the thing happens and you're in a new world, a new dimension, and everything's changed. And that before and after event for me was the loss of my sister, who was my only sibling. She and I were close. She was my rock. And her death kind of initiated a series of just difficult events. And, you know, when you lose someone in the prime of their life, she was healthy. She was 37 years old. She had a 3-year-old and an 11-month-old. Your whole family structure gets upended. You get new responsibilities and your future changes. And that just, it was, you know, the brakes, like I hit the brakes of my life and everything stopped. And it was like, okay, what's next? The way I came to write the book was, I guess, you know, as I was grieving and feeling completely inadequate and naive and ill-equipped to grieve, it's like, I've said this before to people, but it's like, you know how your phone knows you better than you know yourself, you know? Yes. It's like the algorithm knew I was grieving, and it sent me this article about historic grief rituals. And I was like, well, now that's very curious. And then I started Googling all of the rituals that it was listing, and it just took me. And then I was checking out books from the library. It, you know, it's just like led me down this path of curiosity for my own sake. And all of a sudden, studying these rituals just helped me start naming all the emotions I was feeling. I was actually working on another book proposal at the time with my agent. And I was just like, I don't know, would this be helpful? COVID had just started. And if we write about this, is there any, would you think this would maybe help people through this season? And so that we pivoted, and I am shocked still that anybody wanted to publish it, because who wants to read about like creepy Victorian, like postmortem photography? I mean, you know, like I thought no one else would be interested, but I'm so grateful that people have resonated and that it's finding a home in many people's bookshelves and hearts. And that means the world to me. So
I have a lot of theories of why this resonates so much. And you're right that you're writing into a particularly salient time, right? An absorbent time for this. We're all in some spot of grief or loss or kind of recouping after a couple of years of what felt like and still feels like waves that broke into our charmed existences.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
We all experience profound interruption where you just realize, right? We all know where we were when it was like Tom Hanks's COVID shut the world down, you know?
Right.
And it's like, it just stopped. And I don't think anyone of us anticipated what that would be like and that it was coming, you know?
And you, I love the way you write about the disorientation of that, right? And you alluded to that earlier. You talked about how you you would visit tragedy or you would visit trauma and then you would go home. You had this muscle, and aid workers in general have this muscle, this kind of buffering, where you, this line where you say vacations are for sissies, time off is for the entitled, and therapy is for the fragile. And the thing is, I don't think aid workers are alone in that. So this
probably not, yeah.
No, just this, and maybe we're talking about upper Midwesterners again, but
yes, and I love you all, but many of you need therapy and don't realize it.
Okay, write it down, peeps. We've been busted. But I wonder about that knee-jerk tendency to maintain this stalwart exterior. I think that is a part of American non-grieving. We are in a season of loss in my family, and I've watched how there's like this moment after, I would say, 3 or 4 weeks, if that, where people start to, first of all, they don't ask anymore. In reference to the title of your book, they step around the hole that's in the middle of the room.
That
St. Millay quote. But there's just like this moment, I feel, that comes really fast where we're just expected to just, now it's time to move on. Now it's time to deal. And it gets in the way of our grieving. So talk to me about that, how that actually messes with us. That's, we think we're helping ourselves to have the stiff upper lip, and actually that's an impediment to doing the thing.
Yeah. Oh, so much to say. I mean, yeah, I think it's so hard because we live in a culture that prizes optimism and bootstraps. Like we're Americans. We pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Like some people say that like the hope of a better tomorrow is written on our DNA, because those of us of European descent came here to kind of leave a bad situation in our homelands to find new horizons on the frontier, you know? And there's this sense that like, there's always like, we have to maintain our positivity. I mean, I think this is baked into our Christian ethos as well, is that if you believe the right things about God, you're going to feel a certain way. And that was the biggest shock of grief to me, was that I thought that because I had a really well-constructed theology of suffering, that God would then give me this deep inner peace and inner joy, even contentment in the midst of my grief. And that if I didn't feel at peace, which, spoiler alert, I did not. If I didn't feel at peace, and that was somehow an indication that I was theologically inept, that I was, that I didn't have a strong enough relationship with God. And so I somehow came to associate happiness with holiness and sadness with lack of faith and grief with lack of faith. And that's just not true. I mean, we see in scripture, and I'm sure we can talk more about this as we go, but we see in scripture so much grief, God indulging our grief, God being a griever himself. And I think there's just this sense in which like, man, we've got to accept that there are things we must do in life that do not feel productive, right? Grief, there's nothing productive probably about grief. Like, but as Americans, it's like, unless we're doing, achieving next horizon, frontier, productivity, optimism, then we feel like we're wasting our time and failing. And that's just not how, that's not a good way to be human. It doesn't really work.
No. And we keep trying it and it doesn't work. So you talked a little bit about this. I'd love for you to flesh this out more. You had this rich, vibrant faith, and you expected it to look a certain way during grief. It did not at all. It would talk about disorienting. You felt like at one point in the book, you talk about how the presence of God felt like it left with your sister. So this double layered grieving and loss and death, you are putting bones and flesh and muscle on this undercurrent that I've felt for years in the church, that we are only telling part of the story. I remember during COVID feeling, during the most dire days, feeling completely, I would come out of church or out of online church and feel like my head was spinning, because either the tone of the sermon or the happy, peppy celebratory songs, I felt like I was watching a TV show. I didn't get it. I didn't understand how we were not talking about how hard this was, and that it wasn't a betrayal of God for us to say, this is horrible.
Yeah.
So is that kind of where you were feeling that, that was so different than you thought?
Absolutely true. You know, and if our worship services are following the model of the Psalms, then 1/3 of our time would be spent in lament and grief and anger, even at our circumstances, even at God from time to time. Well, let me just deconstruct one of our favorite Christian aphorisms, if I may. You know, the phrase, like, it's not a religion, it's a relationship. Okay, like, I get where that comes from. Like, I understand why a walk with God is not rote obedience to some script and, you know, performative rituals. I think totally. That's helpful.
Yeah.
But I think we have sometimes come to believe in kind of our modern religious expressions that life with God is primarily a feeling, if that makes sense. That yet, like, we have this feeling of intimacy with Him. It's very individualistic, right? Like, you're supposed to kind of have this one-on-one relationship with the Lord. The quiet time is everything. The, you know, the these and those things are good. And my goodness, like, the access we have to God as an individual was hard won at the cross. I believe it. I praise
Absolutely.
God for it. But we can't, if Christianity is just a relationship and it's not a religion, well, what happens when that relationship goes through a rocky patch? Like, what? Well, I mean, there, you know, my husband and I go through seasons where we feel distant from one another. We're not connecting. There's this, like, kind of underlying disagreement that's kind of wearing away at us. Like, so what happens? And does it cease to be a marriage? Like, no. And I think sometimes with God, when things fall apart, or when I don't know if it's just like your parasympathetic nervous system is completely broken down. You're just not connecting with Him at that emotional level that we've come to feel entitled to. What does that mean for your faith then? And I wonder sometimes if that's why so many people are walking away from the faith, is because when they lose that sense of relationship, they don't have the patience to kind of walk it out in community. Like, maybe that's time for your faith to become a religion, to become more rote and obedient, and show up for church, whether you feel it or not, show up in the Word, whether you feel it or not, and see where God meets you. And I think that's kind of where I got to when I was grieving, was I was just not feeling like God was present. I wasn't feeling that palliative comfort. And so I thought maybe God wasn't real, or I was failing, or He was failing me. I don't know. And then finally, I think once I realized, like, just maybe show up for your faith, even if you're not feeling it, and see what you discover, like, it, that ended up being pretty transformative for me.
I think maybe the reason I love how you write about this is that you are super respectful and curious and not giving me a 10-step plan, but definitely encouraging me to remember that there are millions of people who walked before me on this road, right? There are so many people who love God and who loved God and who brought all of it to Him and dumped it in His lap and then went to Ash Wednesday service. And so I'd love for you to talk about some of the specific rituals that you talk about in the book. One of the things you talk about, for example, is sitting Shiva. I have dear Jewish friends, and I've watched this from, you know, throughout the years. I love one thing in particular that you talk about is that sitting Shiva, which is a ritual of grief, how to help people through grief. That first week in particular is just a roadmap, right? People come to your house starting at 7:30 in the morning. You are not supposed to look cute. You're not supposed to host them. They are just coming to be with you. And I love that something that just rang true as true is this idea that the folks who come to visit the mourners, to visit the family, take their cues from the family. So if folks are telling stories, they enter into that. If they are weeping, they enter into that. Talk to me about that, because I think that's not just for folks who are sitting Shiva.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I was so fortunate to have my friend Shelley Enerson, who's Jewish. She grew up in Israel. She really unpacked this for me because there's only, I think, so much you can understand as an outsider. There's still only so much I can understand about it, but she helped me pull out these lessons in such powerful ways. And yeah, I think, oh, there's so much out there, Kim, right now, right? About, like, what not to say to a griever.
Yes.
Don't say this, don't say this, don't say this, don't say this. And I appreciate that. But I also get a little bit nervous because I worry that people are going to be so afraid of saying the wrong thing now that like, they're not going to say anything at all.
Yes.
And like, I just want to assure everyone, like your imperfect presence is absolutely better than your absence. Your imperfect words are better than your silence. And I think when I give people advice about what to say to a griever, I love this idea of a mirror, like an image, because that's what the visitors of Shiva do, is they mirror the actions of the mourner. If the mourner's crying, then cry with them. Like there have been so many times where like, I was actually having quite a good day in my grief. And I wanted to talk about, you know, like pumpkin spice lattes and what I'd been watching on Netflix. And someone's like, I need to be a good friend to her and weep with her right now. And it's like, oh goodness. Like I felt like I had finally come up for air. Can we stay in the air for a little bit? And so that just mirror what they're doing. If they're weeping, then weep with them. If they're laughing, it's okay to laugh with a griever. We're human. Like the world is still funny and we still like to laugh at things, even when we're grieving. If we're sharing stories, then you can share a story. And if we're being silent, it's okay to just be silent. But I think we try to follow all of these scripts that we've been given now by these Instagram influencers and the books we're reading about what not to say to grievers. And the easiest thing to remember is just be a mirror, like mirror what the griever's doing and show up in that way. You're going to make mistakes. They would rather you be there. They would rather you be there, and they would rather your imperfect words than nothing at all. You know,
I feel like you've earned such a loud voice at this table. And that is the most practical advice I might have ever heard about coming alongside people who are grieving. Just look, just watch,
yeah.
Just listen. You don't have to have a platitude or an index card.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what's so crazy about studying these grief rituals is that you learn that the people who performed and stewarded and held these rituals throughout culture, they were not therapists. They were not licensed clinical counselors. Now, I am a huge fan of licensed clinical counseling, and I don't love when non-licensed people try to diagnose and like, let's all get credentialed, y'all, if we're going to be doing this. But you don't have to be a professional to come alongside someone and grieve with them well. So don't be afraid or say, I'm not qualified. Your humanity qualifies you. And more than that, your love qualifies you. That's the only qualification you need to comfort a griever is love. And let love lead you, if I may be a bit cheesy.
No, I bring it on.
Let your love lead you. And that's what's going to qualify you.
Oh, I love that. Let's talk a little bit about lament. You mentioned this briefly, that, you know, 1/3 of the Psalms are lament, that the prophetic books of the Bible are just chock full of them. I love it when you write, lament does not deny hope. Rather, lament tests hope's metal, summons it into the darkness where it actually belongs. That's actually where hope is meant to be, right? Mm-hmm. In the darkness.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This has not been my experience. Lament has not been a part of my experience in the American church. And I think it's probably because we haven't paid attention to that definition. So re-educate us on that, please.
Yeah. One of the rituals I study in the book, and it's the first chapter, is about Irish keening, which is just the practice of wailing aloud at a funeral, like in a very unsophisticated, unhinged kind of way. The whole community would gather and these lead keeners would start screaming, and everyone would start screaming and wailing and crying over the dead. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem very godly to me, until I started reading through the Bible with the eyes of a griever for the first time, you know? And there's this beautiful verse in Jeremiah that says, like, call the wailing women, the women who are skilled in the art of wailing, as this like prophetic, it's a prophetic skill set that the community needs. In fact, women were often paid for the skill of wailing in that culture. And there's a very adamant command from God. He says, listen to what I'm saying. Teach your women to wail. Teach your daughters how to wail. And I was just thinking, why would God want us to teach our children to wail? And I think because it's only in lament that we say what's really true in the world, not what we want to be, but what's actually true. And I just have this belief that anytime we say and repeat with our bodies, with our mouths, anytime we meditate on what's true, that's worship, even if that truth is hard. When we say this is not how it should be, no one should die. No mother should be separated from their child. No image bearer should be exploited like that. These injustices are not right. It's not how the world should be. We are naming something true about God, that God is good and God is holy and doesn't want this. We're naming something true about humanity, that humanity is valued and every life matters. When we say those things, even in pain, I think we're worshiping just because we're saying something that's true. And I think it's only in saying what's true that we're able to get to the deeper truth of our hope, of what can be, of God's sovereignty, of what God desires to see. But we have to kind of get through, we have to go through the transformation that happens in those dark places, I think, before we're able to fully worship the light and fully be present in the light, if that makes sense.
Total sense. Absolutely. I think it's such a more grounded and deeply rooted idea of who God is and who we are, if we use that language. I'm wondering, now that you have walked through and are walking through these seasons of grief and now have written about grief and written about rituals of grief, what rituals have you invited into your process of grieving? And, you know, I'm sure that's shifting. This, I know from the schedule of writing books, you write a book and then you wait 80,000 years and then the book comes out.
Yeah.
So right. I'm guessing even now you're in a different spot than you were when you finished this manuscript.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the ritual, because you, the rituals you describe in the book, you're very careful to say you're a student of them, and they have most of the ones that you talked about have largely died out. And that was an intentional decision, right? That you were kind of a quasi-anthropologist looking back. So talk to me about living ritual, what you have invited into your life.
Well, right. And I say this in the book, like, this is not meant to be like a ritual renovation project. Like, there are some of these rituals will probably just never, it's not practical maybe to practice them again. Although I sometimes say I should start telling the bee that the one of the rituals I looked at was telling the bees, is belief that if someone in the household died, you had to go out and tell the bees that the person had died, or else the bees would fly away. We actually have beehives at our house up here. So every now and then I'm like, Tim, did you tell the bees about that thing? He's like, what has happened to you? It's like too far, Amanda. But yeah, like, people aren't probably going to go start telling their bees. I don't know that we're going to start cleaning or covering mirrors again when someone dies. But I think there's a woman, a psychologist, that writes about grief named Dr. Mikkel Harris. She says it's really important to create moments to encounter your pain without judgment from yourself or anyone else. And that's what rituals do, is they create these moments where you can really just swim in the sorrow of it and really encounter it and face it. And so there are some things that I've started doing to just kind of, I don't know, serve as like a release valve for the pain and the anxiety I feel. Sometimes that's reading poetry about loss or grief. Sometimes it's listening to songs or music that are about lament or sorrow or grief, and just allowing myself to have that good cry. I studied the ritual of Decoration Day here in Appalachia. It's definitely dying out as well, but it's the practice of every year you go to the old family graveyard, because people here were buried in family graveyards just down the road. We have a family graveyard. My 5 times great grandfather is buried there. I often go say hello to him. But just even practicing that for myself, of going to our family graveyard and decorating, putting flowers on the graves of my grandparents who are buried there, going to where my sister is buried and just having a moment there, even though that's hard. I don't want to do that. I don't want to look down at the ground and think that she's under there. I don't like that. But I need to allow that pain to have a release in some moment. And so I think when people can create, you know, I think you can do things yourself and create moments yourself, but goodness, a ritual is so much more powerful when it's done in community. And so that's why I love Decoration Day, is because people would come all together to the graveyard to decorate all of the graves together and share stories together. And I'm just finding that it's harder and harder to have these experiences communally. And gosh, if anyone listening has any bright ideas on that, I mean, that's where I feel like I'm kind of at a loss, is I feel like I kind of diagnose a problem, but I don't provide that many solutions for it, you know?
I wondered about that. You discussed that at the end of the book that, you know, we can only do so much on our own. And we do. And the things that you just suggested are incredibly important. I love the idea of a release valve, but a communal release valve seems like something that we kind of need right now, right?
Yeah.
That's why we build memorials. That's why we have moments and days of remembrance. And that's just not the cool thing to do anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I think as so much of our world is deinstitutionalizing and people are leaving their social clubs and, you know, Robert Putnam's big, like, Bowling Alone book, you know, where he says, like, we don't do societal institutions anymore. We live in our kind of insulated nuclear families and that's it. The church is one of the last few communal institutions that feels like it's still, well, some would say it's not functioning well, but I still believe that there's strength there. My great plea, I guess, would just be for the church to kind of take up the mantle of holding sorrow for people. And we at our church, we try to work in a moment of lament as often as we can. And so that means maybe singing a song that's more focused on lament, or praying a prayer, or holding space for the grievers in the room, or holding space for the you know, exploited or the lonely or whomever in the room. And just having that moment of recognition once every 2 weeks or however often, I think is important. I think churches could get creative about that. And that would certainly be a model for the greater world. I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
No, I love even just starting to think about that and talk about that. And my guess is that is the first very important piece of the puzzle, just turning our attention to it, because I feel like we've had blinders on, which has not helped us. It has not. I don't think we come out on the other side of uber positivity and don't worry, this is all going to be okay. I don't think you come to the end of that and think, wow, it really is. I think it just kind of comes out sideways. So a couple more questions. First, near the end of your book, you distill all that you've learned about grief and loss and ritual into one piece of advice. Well done, you, by the way. But you had to sit on this for a while. And your piece of advice is to stay. This, you're speaking specifically to the griever. Stay on the path, lean into the elements, carry the load, and don't put it down. Endure. You will reap a harvest. God will help you. This advice to me seems very hard won. And again, your voice carries so much weight in this conversation because of the path that you have weathered. And while that advice to me feels like such a sturdy compass to those of us who are facing grief from our own loss, it also feels like the best advice for the folks who aren't currently in their own moment of grief, but who are walking alongside people to stay, to support, to walk. The harvest will come for both of you, right? One step, a little bit down the road. So do those words still ring true? Is that, have they been tested? And by them?
You know, it's interesting. As I wrote, I found myself typing that paragraph. It wasn't that I had to sit and put a lot of thought into it. It felt like to me, the very obvious conclusion was that I started out with this deep sense of urgency to get around the corner, to just get over the hill, to get over the hump and to be okay. And I had a moment where I finally realized, like, you will never be okay. This will never not be sad. The bad thing that happened will never be good. Like, no amount of redemption or silver linings will make it categorically good. It is categorically bad. And you have to hold that the rest of your life. And what you realize is not that the load gets lighter, but that you become stronger. It's like, you have to stay, man. You can't just vacate emotionally. You can't numb, or, you know, all the different things that we do to palliate, numb our feelings and ignore. You have to face them, and you will develop the strength to carry it. And you'll be on this road a long time, you know, and that's what it means to love. That's just the risk we all take when we love anybody or a dream. Anytime we hope, anytime we want anything or love anything, whether it be person or place or gift of any kind, we take the risk of losing it. And that's the journey that follows, you know, it's all part of it.
Amanda, I love here's what I see in what you're doing and how you're writing. You talk in the book a little bit about how the furrows, I'm an Iowa person, and so I see fields all the time. We're in harvest right now.
Yes.
And you talk about the furrowing, you know, kind of the chasms created by grief in us are there to also give us deeper joy, deeper contentment, deeper gratitude, a deeper understanding of grace. That is the most beautiful way to find our way through this. And so I think you are doing that. You write about it beautifully, and it sounds like you live that beautifully. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to write this book. One version could have been, here's my grief. I'm going to learn all of this. I'm going to keep it to myself. And I just want to thank you for doing that. At some point in the book, you say, maybe I should have waited to know more. I'm so glad you didn't wait, not only because I need this book this week, but also because there is a tenderness and a rawness and a freshness of the way you write that you won't have in 4 years. It'll just look different. Yeah. The prism will shift. The light will change.
Absolutely.
So thank you for taking the time to do this. You have young children. I have no idea how you did it, but one mom to another and one griever to another, thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank my daughters for being good nappers. It's the only reason this book exists. And honestly, it's been a gift to me because every time I get to have a conversation like this one with someone as wise and articulate as you, I learn something new about grief too, you know, and that's the great gift about having written this book is I'm getting to learn even more as I go. So
well, I hope this is the first of 8 million books that you read. You need to get off this phone call because I want you to go start the next one.
Yeah, well, my kids don't nap as well as I used to, so.
It's okay. Kindergarten's coming. I've been down that spot.
Oh, thank you. Okay, good. Good to know.
But before I let you go, I have one quick question that's a little bit of a pivot. It can be a pivot or it can be in the same lane. I ask all of my guests. It's a two-prong. Now, because I'm pretty sure you're a book nerd, I've read the bibliography. You are very well read. This is a book nerd question. First part of the question is, what is a book that you return to over and over? You return to in terms of recommending to other people. It can be very old, backlist titles. We love them. And then the second part of the question, is there a book on your horizon that you're looking forward to devouring soon?
Well, the work I go back to again and again, Wendell Berry, a writer, an author, a poet that roots me in place, in my creatureliness, in humility and simplicity. Just his voicing gets me in the cadence of writing, but more than anything, like just his work on, you know, he's a farmer, an activist, his love for nature, I think just roots me back into the things that are timeless and ageless and constant and God created, you know, that have the fingerprints of God all over them. So I love his poetry. I have read much of his fiction and nonfiction work, but I would commend him to anybody whose soul needs to be studied.
Okay. He's a gap on my shelf. I hear his name constantly. I have a long list and I think I'm bumping him to the top because I hear this over and over. Do you have any particular book of his that you would recommend?
Well, Jaber Crow, Hannah Coulter are kind of his like ones people often speak about as being so impactful. Hannah Coulter is a beautiful work about grief and what it is to move forward in, you know, after grief, in the midst of grief. So, but his work of collected work of poetry is what I just keep on my bedside table.
Perfect. Great recommendation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And something I'm looking forward to, I'm discovering the work and brilliance of Hannah Anderson. I just got her book, Let Heaven and Nature Sing. That's what it's called. Yes. Let Heaven and Nature Sing, for her, Christmas Advent writings. She's just a beautiful writer, insightful woman of faith. And she is also from the Blue Ridge of Appalachia. And so we got that in common. So I resonate with her and what she writes. So, yeah.
Fantastic. We will put the links to all these things in show notes so people can go straight to those places. Awesome. Amanda, thank you a million times over for what you're doing, how you're doing it, and for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for everything you do. And thanks for the conversation, Kim.
Come to Iowa. I'm ready for you.
Oh, yes. I'll stop by on my way to my friend's house.
Awesome.
We recorded this episode on my birthday, and the entire conversation was a gift to me. Then I gifted it immediately to others by ordering another copy of Amanda's book and sending it to someone I love fiercely, who's in the throes of grief. And then I went out of my office and found Mark had stopped home with a bouquet of tulips, so I sat right down by those flowers and ate a big slice of birthday cake. Joy, sorrow, all in one moment. Just exactly how this life gig goes, right? Thank you for spending time with us today. I just can't wait to be back together soon, to stay curious together, and to share this stretch of road wherever it takes us. For real.